Okay, let's sit together for maybe 5-10 minutes. I'll read our retreat description now. We're in the middle of the retreat to see if it sounds anything like your retreat, even in moments. Right? It's called The Eye of the Heart, Tracing a Path to Soulfulness, a Brahmaviharas and Soul-Making Dharma Retreat. With our bodies as home base and emptiness as our ground, we will cultivate the four beautiful qualities of the heart: kindness, joy, compassion, and equanimity. Loosening the views and the personality patterns that limit our heart and engaging the liberating gifts of our imagination, we will deepen our capacity to rest in the boundless heart. And from here we will venture, engaging in contemplative ways of looking to explore a soulful and enchanted cosmos, a cosmos in which our particularities are needed, loved, and woven into a sacred and meaningful story. So we have begun with that second venture, and we have begun with the possibility of working with images, with ways of looking that open. You know, one time I was sitting with Rob in my Rob Bebea, who is probably, you've heard the name, but he's the very beautiful and brilliant kind of, what would you call it?
Sage.
Sage is a nice word, isn't it? It's not too, yeah, lovely, sage. Yeah, he's nodding. Yeah, sage is nice. I like that. Thank you. And I was sitting on my sofa in the living room, and had begun working together with a creative, dynamic, spiritual friendship in this, as the paradigm of soul making was emerging. And we were sitting kind of opposite ends, facing each other, and it was so much fun. It was so much fun. I said, "What is it we're doing exactly?" And he said, like a kind of bolt from the blue, he just said, "Restoring, opening, and expanding senses of sacredness." It's like, all right. restoring, opening, and expanding senses of sacredness. Yeah, so that's the intention. And I'm going to say, there'll be a few pieces tonight, including hearing a little bit from Rob as well. I'm going to start with one of your questions that came, and I'll answer it here. I think it might be helpful. So we're beginning with working with images, and it is, there's so much to it. So your questions are really, really welcome. This one says, how do we differentiate imaginal practice from psychological work, e.g. active imagination, which might be one kind? I find it harder to grant autonomy and otherness to an image if the psychological metaphor is too on the nose, right? Really important. So an image can arise that, and I'll give examples which may or may not be that person's exact thing, but hopefully you can get the territory. So I might be sensitive, I'm exploring, and let's say it is dukkha. That would be there. Let's say there's some difficulty arising. And I'm open to image, and an image arises, and quite frankly, it just looks like me suffering, right? Good, good. Right, and it might be me as a child suffering, or it might be an image that sort of seems like, oh, it represents the kind of suffering that I'm going through. So, for example, I remember, and you can have a whole range, but I remember an image, there was really some distress in my heart, and I was open to image, and an image arose of a thin stick woman, you know, like the kind you would draw, a stick drawing, a stick woman sort of in a very thin white, wasn't even a dress really, like a shift, like a sort of institutional dress in a way, sort of cowering in the corner. And on one level it's like, oh, that's a completely clear representation of the suffering that's here. So a couple of things to say about that. What's so good at helpful, I think, about this paradigm, it's really, really dependent on our ways of looking, right? So what that could mean is I might decide to see the image within a purely psychological framework. And that would be completely valid, potentially very healing, and potentially very wise. And it might be a particular framework that I've learned or I'm being helped with. You know, so for some years I had the good fortune to do some trauma therapy, right? And in that context, it's like I parked in the logos, the conceptual framework of that particular paradigm. So I'm, even if it wasn't my only paradigm and wasn't the only thing, I thought, actually, I really need to learn something in this paradigm. I can really benefit from that. So if images would arise there and I was working with the therapist, then I would see those images on those terms, in those categories. So I really want to validate that. What else is possible here doesn't mean we have to have healed everything first before we can do this. No, because there can be other kinds of healing that come on the back of a primary intention, which might be to serve the image, to serve the sacredness. So I'm going to answer that, but one aside. One of the elements of soul making, which I hinted at last night, of an imaginal way of looking, is what Rob called fullness of intention. Fullness of intention is that my primary intention here is in the service of the beauty and the sacredness. The primary intention isn't for my psychological healing, although that may well and very likely happen in very ways that we couldn't have predicted. But my primary looking is out of the sheer beauty. I just want to serve you. So, for example, same image might arise, me as a child, me as a stick lady, and I'm actually, right now, I'm going to see through soul-making ways of looking. I'm going to look this way, with which we will say how you do more. I'm going to look towards the image this way. And I know it's got echoes of my psychological, of my stuff. I know that. I can feel that. It's clear. I'm distressed. She's distressed. Right? It's clear. Yeah. But I don't stop there. So in my view, I'm not wrapping, circumscribing the territory, the size of the cloth to that. I am acknowledging there's more here. I might decide to see it this way through this particular psychological paradigm, because that's really skillful to learn it. It's like a set of ways of looking, actually, that could be really helpful. But right now, I'm going to decide to see it this way. And as I looked towards the stick lady, I'm not careful at that, you know, I'm not bypassing as such, because I'm sensing the distress is there, but I'm sensing wider than that, and I see her And the distress is one level that's being held. Yes, yes, absolutely. But there's enough room that I'm not, because I have had some other support, I'm not completely identified with the distress. Yeah. And I start to see the stick lady, and I see she has like this long black hair. She doesn't look like me anymore. She has this long, long black hair. And wow, it looks like it's full of tar. Her hair is like completely thick with tar, and it's like, wow. She looks really, really in a bad way. Like thick tar, like stuck and matted in her hair. And yes, I recognize there's some resonance here, but there's more that starts to catch my imagination. It's like, ooh, this is a little bit off the map now. Okay. And I could start to look like towards her, like, okay, this is a course for the Brahmaviharas. That would be one, another set of ways of looking. And I resonate and I breathe with her and with me, and let's say compassion arises, or equanimity arises, right? There's a whole other beautiful set of ways of looking to be with her, right? And then maybe that feels steady enough, and I have an intuition that there's more here. Like, what if I don't even assume now one single causal explanation for her? What if I don't limit her as just her suffering? What if I don't limit her to, oh, the reflection of this trauma, which may really need some good care? But I acknowledge, what if I can't ever wrap my mind around this? And as I acknowledge her unfathomable, like there's more, there's a complete, I can't get to the bottom of this. And I start to see her and her hair. Yes, I have been resonating with the distress. Yes, with the compassion. Yes, with the recognition of where this is personally relevant to me. Yes. And I see her hair, and that black tar starts to become thick, thick, like her hair becomes thick and black, and so silky, like this lush black hair. This lush black hair falls down her back. It's the most beautiful hair I've ever seen. And it's thick and it's lustrous, you know, like it knows something about suffering, but it's like lustrous. Its blackness is so dark, like the night sky. And something in me starts to fall in love with her. And as I fall in love with her hair, she looks at me differently. We're not disappearing from the realm of pain, but that is one level that's here. That's one level that has been and continues to be cared for as we resonate with more dimensions that start to come online. And she looks towards me, and I feel humble. Humble, yes, with the pain, yes, but that's not really the whole cause of the humility. That's really a place for the sensitivities to have been worked. A humility that I am in contact with something that does not have a single cause, that does not have a single explanation, that I respect by not circumscribing with any one conceptual framework or healing paradigm. And she, yes, is allowed to remain utterly other, radically other, something before whom I can bow. Like to read a very famous part of a very famous sutta. Who knows what sutta I'm going to read? At this point in the retreat, there could be many. Is it you? Where are you? I'll look again. So this is the Kacchayanagota Sutta. Is that how you say it?
I think so.
I never know how to say it. It's from the Pali Canon. Does anyone know how would you like to say Kacchayana? It's somebody's name. Kacchayanagota. That makes him sound Swedish.
Kacchayana. Yes. Like the Pali pronunciation would be Kacchayanagota.
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 Thank you. That does make him, now he appears Swedish in my mind. But why not? But why not? I know you're not Swedish, but that's how my limited rhythm hearing of melodies happens. And that's somebody's name. Tukachayana. And it's on right view. Now there are many suttas in the Pali Canon that talk about different things. Obviously. And this famous idea of the middle way. And this is a particular version of the Buddha speaking about the middle way, which often is spoken about as the finding the middle way between asceticism and indulgence. Right? You find that middle way for your wise effort. This is another take on the middle way that a lot of the Mahayana, or most of the Mahayana Buddhism, the later Buddhism, is resting on in some way. It's resting on many, many good things, but from the Pali Canon route, you might see this one. I won't read it all, but this is referring to another element of our way of looking towards images, that I think I'll maybe leave it to Rob to say a bit later on the recording. Dwelling at Savati in Jetta's Grove, then Venerable Kacchayanagota approached the Blessed One. The Blessed One is the Buddha. And on arriving, having bowed down, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "Lord, right view, right view," it is said. "To what extent is there right view?" And the Buddha liked a question. And the Buddha begins to respond. "By and large, Kacchayana, this world is supported and takes as its object a polarity, that of existence and non-existence. But when one sees the origination of the world," and remember Yuha's been telling us, the world isn't just the earth, the world is the arising of the mind and perception, the rising of the mind and the world. "When one sees the origination of the world as it actually is with right discernment, non-existence with reference to the world does not occur to one. When one sees the cessation of the world as it actually is, with right discernment, existence with reference to the world does not occur to one. Everything exists, that is one extreme. Everything doesn't exist, that is the second extreme. Avoiding these two extremes, the Tathagata," the one who has gone beyond, the Gata, a bit like the Gate, "the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma via the middle. Everything exists, that's really, really, really real. No, it's not real at all. That's our binary. And the Buddha teaches the way through the middle, not asserting that things do exist and not asserting that they do not. This, yes, a few smiles in the room. Actually, there's a lot of smiles. And if you don't have a smile, don't worry, you don't have to have a smile. If you're confounded, that is also good. Confounded, huh? Right? What it does as a view that isn't just from ahead, it's not only a head view, that's a good start, but that can become a way of looking through practice, through also through kind of intuition, but through practice that can really deepen and become an established ground. And that will open the way of emptiness, and that will open the legitimacy of the imaginal, the malleability of the imaginal, the profundity of the imaginal perceptions that we start to learn how to come into relationship with in this path. So you can just see where that leaves you, really. Not just as an abstract idea, but see that every moment we are actually coming with a way of looking, and that way of looking will usually be asserting it's real or it's not real. Relating to things as they really do exist, or no, they really don't exist. And maybe you can feel, if you sense up your midline of your body and your heart, your imagination, how this loosens and liquefies the infinite malleable potentialities of our participation. So I would like to play a little bit. This is the different kind of play. I'm going to play a recording, which hopefully will also be a play. A little bit of a recording from Rob. It will just be a section of a talk he gave, notoriously known for giving very, very long talks. He had so much to say. And, you know, particularly knowing that death was coming in those sort of 5 years with a pancreatic cancer diagnosis, the urgency to share what he wanted to share is part of why those talks are so long, part of why they came out and so much got delivered in those very, very creative 5 years between diagnosis of a terminal illness and dying. So, I think I wanted to say something before I played Rob here. Yuha's looking at my screen and he's seeing how untidy my desktop is. And he's not surprised, so I'm not sure why. So. Is that what you were thinking? There's Rob, and then where's my notes? There they are. Oh, yeah. So in the example I gave last night with the image, those of you who know the frameworks will have seen some of what I was doing from a teacher perspective. One of the things I was doing when I went aside, I did all those asides, I was highlighting an element of what has come to be called the lattice of imaginal perception. A lattice in English is a word for like something that you would grow roses up, that you put on the wall. It's like a crisscross like a net, right? Like a net where the ropes cross each other, and at the point of intersection, there's a little node of contact, right? And all ways of looking will have a number of elements that are feeding the way of looking, like our emotions, our views, our ideas about things, our energy body awareness, where our attention goes, our patterns, our somatic patterning, kinds of things. And in this lattice, these elements, it's not an exhaustive list, there can be more, but these elements at each of those intersections of the ropes, and you can imagine it how you like, you know, even a net is a little bit only three-dimensional, and ideally we'd want to be able to visualize like more dimensions. Maybe the net goes this way or this way or this way. But anyway, lots of intersecting places. And at those intersections, imagine like little nodes. Node is like the word, I don't know if you know that word, but it's the word we would give to lymph nodes, you know, little spots of importance that are part of a big map. And in that talk last night, as I went to the aside, some of those will have been either named directly or referred to slightly more obliquely. To learn these elements, to reflect on them, is to be able to train our ways of looking, actually. It's not just a kind of a stumble into the grace. I had a good friend, actually, an older man, who was a Jungian analyst in Britain, and we had a dialogue together, and he would say, "Oh, it's just a grace when an image arises. It's like I can't do anything about it." Right? And it was beautiful. He was a beautiful man and had lots of that I could learn, of course. And that's not exactly how we would see it. Here, we would see it's not just a grace we stumble into, we can participate and actually quite technically in this art. It's actually got a sort of science in it, I think, and that's part of Rob's gift. It's got a precision in it. And these 28 elements, we can learn to recognize them when we're working with image, we can learn to invite them when we're working with image, we can sometimes sense them all operating in our way of looking, or we can also sense, oh, there's only a few, I wonder if some more. What happens if I switch on this one? For example, one of the ones is grace, actually. It's like, oh, I recognize there's a gift here, there's grace. This is me switching on the, this is me rubbing the node of the lattice, right? It's like, oh, that's illuminating this way of looking. Not only illuminating, it's actually conditioning this way of looking. One of them is grace, but then you'll see that another one of them, which is over here on my map today, but doesn't have to be over here, right, is, will be a nice contrast that's got a very different vibe from grace.
Logos.
Logos. Logos. Another Greek word. Actually, that's a whole really interesting thing. In fact, that man, that really lovely Jungian man, he told me that logos was first used. Do you want to know this?
Really? Yeah.
I found this super interesting. So this is personally relevant, maybe to some of you. I'm going to try and do a summary of both my personal prejudice around logos previously and the restoration of relationship with concepts and conceptual frameworks. And something about understanding for what he shared with me, that logos, meaning, you know, it's the beginning of the Bible, isn't it? Or the New Testament. In the beginning, logos meaning word. In the beginning was the logos, yeah. In the beginning, and then... but before that, used in the Greek tradition, originally by Heraclitus, I believe, And Logos, which I had come to have a relationship with, ideas and conceptual frameworks, I was a little bit rather judgmental of that way of knowing for all kinds of reasons. And partly because I thought, erroneously, mistakenly, that conceptual frameworks were only abstract, which is actually also has value, but were only abstract and therefore didn't have anything to do really with this living, puffing, suffering creature, right? So I had this split in my mind, and or any other creatures for that matter, and all the prejudices that I, in the historical scene of this splitting between ideas and concepts and the living world. And he told me Heraclitus, that word originally didn't have that connotation at all of being only abstract. And it actually pertains a little bit to what Juha said this morning of where frameworks, philosophy and actual, how did you put it? But basically, this is how I heard it. The philosophy and ideas and the very living instrument of entering into the mysticism are completely woven together, right? Not, I learn the map and then I enter, or I don't need a map, I'll just enter intuitively, great. But actually, that's can go a bit wonky sometimes, even though the intuition is incredibly important. And that Heraclitus' connotation of logos was how my friend put it and wrote articles about it, was that the very living world was logos. The very way that the world kind of emerges, the organic world emerges, that itself was the logos. The very frames and what the frames are hanging on, all arising together, this is the logos, right? Maybe you knew that already. I mean, not necessarily the history, maybe a relationship between ideas and between the living, breathing creatures. Maybe you don't have an issue. But I did, and if you do, whichever way around it is. Oh, no, I'm happier in the ideas. This living, breathing stuff's a bit scary. Yeah. Whichever way around it is, then this is a very... There's a lot of healing that will come with this, actually. There has been for me. Yeah. So, logos. Grace, like I feel like I'm being given a gift. And another element is logos. There are not only conceptual frameworks here, there are inevitably conceptual frameworks to every way of looking, every moment. Let's look at these conceptual frameworks. Let them act like a womb. It's like they can be like this womb, and we can choose deliberately the womb that we create, enter into. Right? We can. We are instrumental in that. We participate in the kinds of conceptual frameworks we go towards, often unconsciously. I.e. there'll be the default frameworks of the cultures and the, yeah, which some of them are great. Yeah. But we can be deliberate, so it's not just a grace. It's not only that I'm being given an incredible gift that I didn't deserve, but actually I'm participating in that through ideas of big concepts, like what things are, and small concepts that fertilize the womb. Like, what happens if I try on the idea that the image can see me? What happens if I try on that idea and sense the effect? Does it lead in the direction of soulfulness? So, 28 elements, I'll let Rob tell us then. And just got time for you, Rob. as you listen, see which one, if there's one that sort of lights up for you today, lights up either because you love it, it lights up because you think, what on earth is that? You light up because you think, that's the one for me today. That was the missing one. I want to know that. What lights up for you? And we'll play with them more a little bit later. So here's Rob as a section of a talk, and this was from 2018 at Gaia House. And anyway, this was in the earlier time of him putting out this frame, this lattice idea of all these nodes. I think maybe that's what I'll say. So he goes through the list quite fast, but I wanted his voice here. I also get to hear a little bit of him just like, yeah, okay, that's this. And yeah. All right. Are you ready?
I'm not 100% sure this is the one, but let's try.
Into
your own hands a little.
Yeah. Does it just turn itself off?
A little bit. Ask.
Louder.
Probably turn it up.
Oh, my one. Mine's full. Right. That used to mean engaged.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Logos have changed.
Logos have changed. Really, yeah, really has.
Same sound, different.
Yeah, right.
Seek out.
What? Just the whole thing? You want to hear the list? I'll just name them. And some of them won't mean anything to you at all at this point, and that's fine. I'm probably going to go through it too fast to write it down at this point. Well, you can try. It depends how fast you write. So we can have a race. Not in any order. This is the important thing. This is, this is the thing about dependent arising. There's not like cause and effect. There's the mutual arising and the mutual fading. Okay. So, 28 items, as I said, some of them, it's not exhaustive as well, so some of them are kind of imply each other, imply another one, or kind of overlap and involve each other, and some of them kind of seem like, well, they're kind of opposite, okay, so anyway, the first one is the lattice or the constellation itself. In other words, the first thing about the imaginal constellation is that it is a constellation, and the recognition of that. And the implication of that is that a thing is not an image by itself. Nothing is anything by itself, actually, in any perception or anything. So when we say imaginal, we're not talking about just a kind of object. Here's, some mythic-looking creature. They call griffins. What's a griffin? it doesn't mean it's imaginal. It's in the relationship. It's in the whole constellation. So the first thing is, an image is as much about my way of looking, my way of conceiving, my way of relating, as it is about the objective part. So some of these elements are more subjective, and some are more objective. In other words, they seem to characterize more the subjective part, and some seem to characterize more the object. In the sense of the image is the object, and the subject is me as practitioner. Okay, the first one is the very fact of the constellation itself. Second, not in any particular order, is the energy body, the involvement and the awareness and the sensitivity to the whole energy body. So that's an example of a subjective one. Yeah, it's here. I'll come back. I'm just listening now, and I'll come back to some of them. Third one I've actually also already mentioned: love and being loved. Love The flow, the two-way flow of love is inherent in the imaginal. Number four, eros, which includes love but is more than love, as Catherine pointed out. Fifth is beauty, something that touches us with a sense of beauty in this image. And again, it might not be beauty in the sense that I typically think of what is beautiful, but somehow the soul finds in this, in whatever this is, a sense of beauty. The seventh is that it's all different down here.
There's no established list.
All right, I'll try to do it. Okay, the sixth is trust. Okay, and there's I'll come back to this morning. Hopefully, if I get some time, I'll come back to that one. Trust. Trust is an element, and again, in a way, that would be a two-way thing. I somehow trust this image. I also trust the whole process. The whole process of what we're doing here. That's a level of trust. And also, I trust this image. It may look violent. It may look like pathologically disturbed. It may look really weird or crazy. Trust is an element. I'm talking now about trust on that as well. And in fact, we talked about it earlier with this doubt thing, like not to buy into it. Trust is, again, when there is no trust, the imaginal will not open up, as it goes for all these. It won't open up fully. It will just stay as an image, a bit more flat. But if I can introduce some trust, just a grain of trust, this thing is not what I'm used to. This thing looks like it's defilement. This thing, whatever it is, if I can introduce that, then that trust, again, in the dependent arising of things, it's like I put a grain of some kind of alchemical elixir in, just some trust, and that does something, as always does. It opens things out. Without the trust, it won't open out. Now, of course, human relationships are like that as well, aren't they? But basically, dealing with images is a lot like just you're in relationship. One way of saying what we're saying this morning is the whole thing is relational. We're talking about relationship in lots of different ways. So sometimes this is hard, the trust thing. It's not like, oh, this is really easy, for lots of different reasons. But I think I said it in the Q&A last afternoon. You can sometimes just put a ring fence around it. 5 minutes, I'm going to play with some trust. I sprinkle that. You don't really sprinkle elixir, do you? Pour a grain of sand of trust, whatever it is. At 5 minutes, I ring fence it. And afterwards, thank you very much. That was my little experiment in trust. And I can go back to holding it arm's length or being slightly suspicious. So don't push yourself. but you'll probably notice something, as I said, that in that 5 minutes, the trust has an effect. It has to have an effect because the whole thing is dependent arising relational. Okie dokie. So seven is an imaginal image in our sense is soul making. In other words, there is a sense of soulfulness. And it's partly circular implied in all this, all the beauty and the love and the depth and all that. And soul-making means that the eros, psyche, logos dynamic, what Catherine referred to the other night, that is active, it's kicking in. All these things are opening each other and creating more complexity and beauty and all that. And soulfulness is more than heartfulness. It includes heartfulness, but it's more than heartfulness. Number eight is a sense of dimensionality. This is not easy to put into words or even sometimes pinpoint sometimes. But that dimensionality, it's as if this thing is not flat. It has the vague sense of other dimensions to it. And these dimensions kind of move forward into divinity. Recede into divinity. The divinity is implicit in this work, is in this direction of dimensionality.